Henry Manny was born in 1928, on the eve of the stock market crash and the Great Depression and Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. As American farms, cities, towns, and industries moved through these crisis years, Henry Manny grew up working in his father's general store in Memphis, Tennessee. Manny's grandparents were Jewish immigrants from Romania who had come to America for a better life and found it. Young Henry Manny majored in economics at Vanderbilt University and quickly followed with a law degree at the University of Chicago, becoming fascinated with corporate management and ownership, antitrust, and the stock market. He wrote extensively about finance economics, the market, and the Securities and Exchange Commission. He was an early visionary in the field of law and economics, a noted innovator in legal education, and founded the Center for Law and Economics. Fred McChesney has been a student and colleague of Henry Manny for many years. He's a professor at Northwestern University School of Law and Kellogg School of Management. In 2005, the two met again at the Liberty Fund in Indianapolis, Indiana, for A Conversation with Henry Manny.
I would begin by noting that throughout these various facets of your career, I discern a constant theme, a constant emphasis on economic liberty, personal liberty, and wonder if this is something that you picked up as part of growing up. Is this something that was stressed in your family? Where did this emphasis come from?
I think that part of it does come out of family history. I had a grandfather who fled Eastern Europe to avoid being drafted into the Tsar's army. That was a kind of quest for liberty right there. Much of my family recollections relate to a commercial life. My father had a store, my grandfather had a store in a small town in southeast Missouri. My father's store was in Memphis, and I sort of grew up familiar with the idea of buying and selling and people having their needs supplied by other people who made a living at it. So that I always could relate back to this kind of thing. There was also always the issue of religious freedom, which obviously is part of the whole package of liberties, because my family was Jewish and there was anti-Semitism that was noticeable to me as a child, and certainly that my parents and grandparents had suffered. It was something that was talked about from time to time, and you came to have a sense of the virtue of a free society where people didn't have to worry about that kind of thing. My whole life's philosophy can be traced back to those early beginnings. My father came to this country, but my mother's family had been here for a couple of generations before in southeast Missouri, New Madrid.
And was it your mother's side of the family that came over from Romania?
That's right. My great-grandfather, sometime around between 1880 and 1885, and he was a peddler, and as frequently happened, I think this was a history of a lot of the small towns in the Midwest and the South, these peddlers identified an opportunity. There was a town with no general store or no substantial one. And he started this general store, Shaneberg's, in New Madrid, Missouri, probably in late 1880s, 1890. But he was a very Orthodox Jew, and he didn't like living in New Madrid where he couldn't keep a kosher household. Now, his son, my grandfather, had come over to this country with him, and he put him in charge of the business, and he went back to Memphis, had a little store on North Main Street in Memphis, which was a very Jewish area of Memphis then. And my grandfather was very successful in building this business. My grandmother was a contract bride who came from the same village back in Romania. But she mastered the American way of doing things very well. And my father was a traveling salesman who had come to this country from South Africa. He was in, his family originally had come from London to South Africa. He had fought in World War I with his four brothers, and after the war was kind of a wanderlust, and he ended up first working for Thomas Edison in New Jersey and then out of St. Louis as traveling salesman, where he called on the Schaumburg store in New Madrid. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Your dad worked for...
Yes, his first job in the United States in 1921 was to work for Thomas Edison, who hired him personally, liked him, and hired him on the spot. But 2 years later, Thomas Edison had come under the baleful influence of Henry Ford, who was a very noted anti-Semite.
Right.
And on one day, all Jews in all of the Edison companies and all of the Ford companies were given their pink slip. That's how he happened to then go to St. Louis and eventually met my mother in New Madrid, Missouri.
Were you involved yourself in any of the business activities of the family?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, we lived in an apartment behind my father's store. And I, as a young child, I suppose 6 or 7 years old, worked in the store. It was sort of almost a joke, but I would wait on people for small items. I can remember matching thread to materials and things like that. And then I grew up through high school years playing an active part in that store, so that commercial activities were very familiar to me. I remember when I went to law school that I had an advantage over almost everyone else in the class because no one else had ever seen a bill of lading. Well, I knew what a bill of lading was. So it's funny how those things come back.
Did any of the economic aspects of World War II have any impact on the Memphis store?
Well, yes, and I suspect even on my own thinking. Certainly I could see how markets surmounted, black markets they called them, but they were markets, surmounted restrictions that probably really didn't make any sense. I guess the final judgment's not fully in on that, but I doubt seriously that we ever really benefited from the rationing and such that went on.
Did you ever contemplate staying in the business?
Certainly early in college, I was attracted to the idea of an academic career.
So you left Memphis for Vanderbilt?
Vanderbilt.
What did you study?
Well, I started on to major in mathematics, of all things, but I took a course in economics that captivated me from the very first course. And I got the idea, well, why not combine mathematics and economics? Strange as that sounds today in a world where every economist is at least an amateur mathematician, if not a professional, there was no one at Vanderbilt who would suggest to me that there was any relationship between the two. They said, well, if you want to major in math, you could be an actuary, but they didn't see any other relationship to economics. Keynesian economics was the only thing. Keynes' general theory had come out in 1946 when I entered college. By 1949, it was the dominant Bible of economics. There hardly was a microeconomics. There were very few departments in the United States that really even had a focus on microeconomics any longer. The University of Virginia was one, Chicago was one, Vanderbilt became one, UCLA, at least later, became so. But every other economics department in the country wanted to do nothing but Keynesian macroeconomics. My interest was much greater in on the micro side, history of economic thought, economic philosophy. the various parts that later came together for me. Although it was interesting, even in college, I read a work that was critical in my life as an influence, negative, I suppose, and that was Burley and Means, The Modern Corporation and Private Property.
First published in 1932, The Modern Corporation and Private Property by Adolph Burley and Gardner Means had popularized the idea of the separation of corporate ownership and control.
A book that would certainly have a major impact on your later work.
Certainly did.
Yeah.
As did Mr. Burley himself. That was the kind of thing that interested me, and I think that was the reason that the professor in that course recommended that I go to the University of Chicago Law School.
You went from Vanderbilt to Chicago?
Yes, immediately. I went through Vanderbilt in 3 years, finished in the summer of 49, and began law school in the following month. I didn't realize that Chicago was quite as different from other law schools. I don't think I realized that fully until I started law teaching quite several years later. I thought there'd be other law schools like Chicago that would have this intense intellectual interest, and particularly in the economics as it related to law. It was just, it was a foreign language to most people in legal education at the time I started teaching. I was told to look him up when I went to Chicago because Raul McKean had worked with him. His name was Aaron Director. To put him in some perspective, he was the brother of a woman named Rose Director, who married an economist named Milton Friedman. Here was this man who had really the most unusual mind and mentality I've ever come across. He used to say it was a steel trap mind. You'd go to him with an issue in law, and he would take it apart and make you see it in a totally different way than you had even thought of when you went to see him. And then he'd put it back together with a rationale of the whole thing that was just amazing. There was a group that had developed in, I think, maybe even had traces into the 1920s, but by the 1930s even, called the American Legal Realists. It was a small group centered heavily at Yale and Columbia with some inroads at Chicago and Wisconsin, I believe, and Northwestern. This group knew there was something wrong with the state of scholarship in law. They didn't exactly know what, but they knew that there had to be something more to understand about law and its role in society and the desirability of particular rules of law. Well, then Aaron Director showed up at Chicago. Now, he had no background in law. He didn't know that the legal realists had even complained about this. He was there to teach a simple course in price theory, but he began doing something very interesting. He began looking at cases, and for an economist in those days, there was only one kind of case that would really be of interest. That was antitrust.
Antitrust, right.
Antitrust was a big field. It had been a big political issue in the 30s when Thurman Arnold was head of the antitrust division. It was an important subject in law schools because it had a big political connotation to it. It was high-level stuff, big money law. So Aaron began reading these cases. There had been many Supreme Court and lower court cases in the antitrust field. And he began telling people, there's something all wrong, there's something crazy about these cases. He said, what the judges say are the facts in the case, which I take as correct, make no sense when the judge gets over to analyzing the case for purposes of discovering whether there's a violation of the Sherman Act or the Clayton Act or what have you. He said, there's a disconnect. Their economics is all wrong. That, of course, was the beginning of what became known as the Chicago School of Antitrust Economics. It later revolutionized antitrust law in the United States when Reagan was president and made Bill Baxter a later protege of directors at Stanford. When Baxter was head of the antitrust division, he brought in this new economics that Aaron Director had begun to develop, and the rest, as they say, is history. We live in a different world today than we did before he picked up those antitrust cases. But he had a marvelously intellectual group of colleagues.
Do I recall correctly also that Aaron Director co-taught antitrust with Ed Levy?
That's right. That was probably the most famous course in the law school, that and one course in constitutional law. We all look forward to it. It was exciting. It was intellectually challenging. Here you had a brilliant legal scholar, Ed Levy, who had been in Thurman Arnold's antitrust division. And he was new to this economics. He was like all the other brilliant young professors in the law school at Chicago at the time. They were enormously curious about what Director was saying. It was palpable. You could feel it. It got through to the students, too, that there was something different and very powerful and very important going on here. Modern law and economics was being born right there. You had a bunch of smart guys who recognized that economics had something to do with this, that American legal realist lawyers were looking for some way to make a breakthrough, to understand better what they were doing. Now, the economics we had was very limited. It's hard to believe it, but this was in the days before Ronald Coase and Armin Alchin had hit the scene. And so we didn't have notions that are very powerful and important in law and economics today, of economics of property rights, for instance, or transactions costs. These are ideas that you know as well as I have transformed economic scholarship, and certainly without which law and economics would probably still be relegated to the antitrust field.
Studying the works of classical liberal authors Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, Manny discovered the glue that held his economics theory together, the European classical liberal tradition.
After I graduated law school at Chicago, I took a graduate fellowship at Yale Law School. Now, Yale was famous as the school that did law and policy. It was thought to have integrated social sciences more into the law school than any other. Just was not true. They had not been nearly as successful as Chicago.
Did you get a second degree there, second law degree?
Well, I got two law degrees there. I went there and was admitted to the program for the doctoral degree, but because I was going to be applying for a commission in JAG, I wanted to get a terminal degree from Yale as well, so they gave me an LLM at the end of the year. So I was a little bit turned off by what I was engaged in and realized that I had accumulated over the 3 years at Chicago, where incidentally I had attended some of the seminars given by Friedrich Hayek. There was in a room in the Harper Library adjoining the old law school, so I only had to walk 30 or 40 yards to go sit in on his seminar. And I had accumulated a list of books by Hayek and von Mises I had heard of from Director that I thought would be interesting for me to read. And I got very interested. I spent much of that year, and so I say Yale is very important in my education, but not for reasons that they think. It was that I had an opportunity to sit and read those important works, which, again, played a large role in my own intellectual development.
And wasn't there also a link between Hayek coming to Chicago and Directors being here at Chicago?
Certainly there was. It's another untold story. It relates to some small, what we would now call libertarian and conservative foundations that had been attracted to the work of people like Hayek and Director and Friedman. One of those foundations, the Volcker Fund from Kansas City, headed by Mr. Volcker, was a great, enormous fan of Friedrich Hayek. Was responsible, for instance, for spreading the famous book, The Road to Serfdom, in America. And he, I believe, funded Hayek through the offices of Aaron Director. Hayek, of course, at this time, after World War II, was engaged in his enormously important enterprise of trying to get together the traditional European liberals, the free market people, back together again to try and make some inroads on what was a socialist avalanche all through Western Europe, certainly in England at the time. The Keynesian work fit right in with that. It wasn't exactly they were different parts of a large animal. And Hayek, in 1947, founded the famous Mont Pelerin Society, and Aaron Director was one of the founding members of that, as well as George Stigler. But this was a tiny group in the whole world. There was maybe 30, 35 men and a few women who felt that they were the last kernel there was of the great liberal tradition of Europe of the 19th century. I think they didn't realize how firmly it really was embedded in American culture generally, not as much intellectually, but certainly the fact that we had business people in the United States like Volcker, like Peer Goodrich, like others who were far-sighted about what an economic system could mean. Law and economics, as we know it today, hadn't been invented. What was holding it together was the liberal tradition of Hayek and von Mises, that I certainly knew that Friedman and Stigler and Director were part of. But one couldn't have the whole picture yet. There were still pieces of that puzzle that had yet to be discovered. While I was in the Air Force, where I was doing legal work, JAG work, I had interviewed for teaching positions and took this position at St. Louis University, which had somewhat philosophic ties to the University of Chicago, but there was no idea of law and economics. The very phrase law and economics was unknown at the time. I was still interested in economics, and as I began teaching, my interest always would be shifted in that direction. I was teaching courses in corporation law, and I thought economics must have something to do with that field, so I began to get interested in the application of economics to various corporate issues.
Soon, Manny was questioning key notions advanced in Burley and Mean's book, The Modern Corporation and Private Property.
Well, it's a somewhat schizophrenic book, perhaps reflecting the fact that we had a lawyer, Burley, and an economist, Means, writing about it. But it's half about corporations and half about property.
That's right.
With only occasional bridges being built across the two.
I think you're absolutely right. I came to know both of the authors. Burley was law professor at Columbia when I wrote an article in 1962 called
The Higher Criticism?
The Higher Criticism of the Modern Corporation.
Separation of ownership from control, meaning that shareholders didn't actually manage their own firms.
That's right.
And the managers ordinarily were not the important shareholders.
That's right. They had a degree of independence so that these two parts went their own way separately.
As compared to a classic firm, typically where the owners also run the firm.
Exactly. And that was the notion of the separation of ownership and control that was popularized in that book. And it was an enormously important book. It appeared right at the earliest part of the New Deal. I think the very first edition of it was 1932 or perhaps 33. It was considered almost a Bible of about the large corporation in the academic world, largely because there was nothing else ever written on the subject. No one had ever paid much intellectual attention to the development of the large corporation. The book was kind of a bombshell.
Right.
It's certainly one of the most important intellectual promotions of the 20th century. It had a profound influence on the New Deal, on our understanding of large corporations. It created a whole culture about large corporations. And yet most of it was all wrong. It was not informed by good economics.
Well, there was actually, as I recall, not a lot of economics in it. It was highly institutional.
Well, the famous phrase that they popularized, the separation of ownership and control, the very connotation was there was something unholy about separating ownership and control. It created the idea that there was something wrong, something fundamentally wrong with the large corporation. While we had a traditional idea that a free market system was pretty good, it had changed as a result of the evolution of this gigantic monster, the modern corporation, that didn't act like consistent with the traditional rules of market economics. And that was grist for the New Deal mill. So the book was couldn't have come out at a better time.
Certainly consistent with the creation of the SEC, passage of the Securities Acts, and what have you.
This first article of mine appeared with a response from Burley. Well, for a young professor, I had only been teaching a few years at that time. That was an enormous shot in the arm to get that kind of recognition.
This is your first really important article involving corporations and corporate law, but it was the first of many. And indeed, if one takes the entire corpus of pieces that you wrote during the, let's say, 1960s, early 1970s, what one really has in the ensemble, if I can use that term, is almost a theory of the firm, a new way of looking at the corporate firm through an economic lens. Would that be a safe summary of what we have at the end of the day?
I hope it is. I had the feeling myself that I was doing something very new. The article that first brought me to academic attention, I guess, the one you just mentioned, the Higher Criticism, Burley had responded to. And I'd had some nice correspondence with him, and I think even at one point in between there I had met him. And then in 64, Columbia Law Review was doing a festschrift in his honor. And had no interest in inviting me. When they presented to him the list of authors, he said, "You can't go forward with this without including Henry Manny."
Henry, you once told me, I think, that in this 1959 or whatever year it was meeting that you had when you met Armin Alchin, that he had made certain recommendations as to things that you might read. Downs, Anthony Downs was one of them. And I would assume that ultimately what you were reading in Downs and in others, other works that Armin recommended, has something to do with the 1964 piece on share voting that was in the Columbia Law Review,
right,
which is the second important corporate law piece that you published. A nascent idea in 1962 and ultimately sees the light of day in the JPE piece, a Journal of Political Economy piece, Mergers in the Market for Corporate Control. Mm-hmm. Now, I will have to tell you that this is my personal favorite of yours. It is an extremely important piece because it changes everybody's thinking about what mergers are really all about. Is that a safe statement?
Oh, I think so. It did two things. It had that implication in the antitrust field that there really was something not all bad about mergers. At that point, antitrust law was death on mergers.
Absolutely
that
right.
It seemed to be the end of competition was the merger.
Any merger the federal government challenged, right. it beat down.
So that one part of that little article is a clear defense offered for the antitrust side of things. And the other was the insight into what was really going on with the management of corporations.
There was a market for corporate control, which had a very powerful influence in keeping management's nose to the grindstone.
Well, you see, it was the direct response, finally articulated. I had been playing with it for some years. But it was the direct response to Burley and Mean's famous notion that management and control were separated in the large corporation, that management, in a sense, was irresponsible, and control was the shareholders, owners, were passive. That was almost the only theory of large corporations. And I began to see that that just didn't make any sense, and that the notion of control that Burley had identified, there was no reason that that couldn't be amenable to economic analysis the same as any other product.
And Downs had himself already referred to a market for votes. Now, he wasn't talking about corporate voting.
That's right.
But he was talking about a market for votes.
Yes. Well, yes and no. There's a famous footnote in Downs, and there's a similar footnote in the little later work by Buchanan and Tulloch, Calculus of Consent, in which they sort of allude to the idea of buying votes. And neither of them liked the idea, all three of them, and they shied away from it. There are very short footnotes in each of those important works saying, in effect, this is too horrible even to think about, that people are buying votes, because it simply sounded like a system of bribery. And yet what I saw was that was precisely what we had. I mean, it wasn't invented, it wasn't an explanation of something. It was the only proper way you could describe what went on in controlled transactions with corporations.
Another remarkable aspect of that piece is your foreshadowing of what now is called the efficient capital market hypothesis.
I was always very proud of that little footnote.
And it really is quite remarkable, because what you were talking about, as I recall, was the possibility ultimately someday of testing a lot of your propositions by looking at stock price data, mm-hmm. at share price data. And if it was really the case that management was bringing value to the firm, this ought to be reflected in share prices. Now, that hardly seems revolutionary to people today, but at the time it was totally revolutionary. And what always impressed me was the numbers didn't yet exist, but you were very willing to say, if I'm right, one day when the numbers come into being, this is what you're going to find.
And see.
And of course, that's exactly what has happened.
No.
Quite remarkable.
It was great fun to do a piece like that. Where you weren't relying on empirical data for your arguments, and where you became totally convinced that you had locked up the logic of the thing and that it was something new.
All 11 pages of it.
That's right. That's
right. There's an awful lot in those 11 pages. You have also written a great deal on issues like corporate philanthropy, and that was a debate that you got into very early. And with a somewhat contrarian stance, what was the genesis of your interest in that?
It was a popular idea, but very superficial. it never even got beyond the idea of, what do you mean when you talk about a corporation giving? How does a corporation own anything? It means you're taking money from the shareholders, ultimately, and giving it. The analysis hadn't even proceeded that far.
This was something that a lot of people talked about. It was, if even Milton Friedman gets into Playboy magazine to talk about corporate philanthropy and corporate giving and what have you, then obviously we're talking about a general subject that a lot of people are paying attention to, but as you say, probably not at a very sophisticated level.
Milton, of course, understood that the academic apologies that were going on for corporate giving didn't make a lot of sense. And that's largely what they were. After all, we are still heavily imbued with the philosophy and the culture of the Depression and the New Deal. The modern acceptance of private property and free markets wasn't that great in those days. And so a lot of corporate PR people love to promote the idea of corporate social responsibility, corporate giving, corporate altruism, in any of these different terms. And they said it was part of the corporate duty as a good citizen. You know, no one stopped to say, what do you mean a corporation is a citizen? A corporation's not a citizen. It's, if anything tangible, it's a piece of paper issued by the Secretary of State.
Indeed, the phrase corporation as a nexus of contracts, which is now chapter and verse, it's in every article. As far as I recall, didn't even exist then.
Nobody to say I didn't invent that phrase.
The piece on our two corporation systems in the Virginia Law Review was one that had a tremendous influence at the time. What was the orthodoxy that you were trying to change and did in fact change?
Well, the orthodoxy was certainly the Burleian Means notion of the separation of ownership and control, which immediately implied a kind of irresponsibility of corporate management, a kind of indefensibility. In a sense, that was what I was aimed at. You know, I realized that you couldn't have a large corporate system that had the kind of faults that Burley was talking about. No system in the world will operate for any period of time with any degree of success with those fundamental faults in it. You would have seen just vast amounts of inefficiency, of criminal behavior, of all sorts of bizarre things. And we didn't see that. Our corporate system was working very well, even today with relatively minor scandals in the totality of things. The system works extraordinarily well because it is a market system. It evolves through a testing that is ultimately the correct testing.
Sandwiched between these various pieces of your writing on the corporation itself, you go off and write insider trading in the stock market. And if you had been controversial before, now you're really controversial.
It was not intended to be that way. I didn't intend to make insider trading in the stock market the focus for most people on me for many, many years. I don't think it was as important economic insight as the stuff on the market for corporate control was. And yet it was of a piece with it. It resulted from the same kind of uneconomically informed lawmaking. With the growth of law, and by that I mean regulation, during the New Deal and the period after, a great many people began to think they could invent solutions to all problems. And you had people like a very nice man, Bill Carey, who was your predecessor as a professor of corporation law at Northwestern, later at Columbia, and later chairman of the SEC. I think Kerry was a perfectly honorable man. I don't think he had a clue about economic forces and how they interplayed with corporate affairs and the market and the stock market. When I say not a clue, I mean not a clue. He thought these were moral issues. They may be, but that sure is not all they are. There's a lot of economics there, and it was very clear when he got started, when he was chairman of the SEC, and began almost illicitly his campaign against insider trading, because the very first action by the SEC was an administrative hearing called Katie Roberts and Company. And now, people didn't pay a great deal of attention to it, and it was a mystery holding altogether. The people who did look at it said, this is very strange that he would use this Rule 10b-5 rather than the broker-dealer disciplinary action sections to discipline a broker. And a lot of people certainly know and realize that he was trying to start a whole campaign about right. insider trading.
Right.
And yet that's what it was. And it just shows so what happens so frequently, I think, with government when they don't understand the economics of something and barge in and they botch it up terribly.
And along comes your book, Insider Trading in the Stock Market, and says, let's think about this in economic terms. It's just compensation.
Well, not just compensation, but it could be compensation. And if it represents a flow of value in a free market, if the market's working, that flow is going to be directed to the place where that value has the highest utility. That is, the system will work efficiently. And so if there are people who are gaining money by insider trading and this continues over a long period, it's not that something illicit is happening that regularly. It's that the market is working in a way to make things better, not worse. In fact, managers wanted people to be trading in the stock market who had information. They didn't view them as stealing something. They didn't view them as getting illicit gains. They viewed them as helping the managers with their function, that the stock market price could give them information that they may not be able to get anywhere else. And I think that probably is going to be my last critical contribution to scholarship, but that's the one I've been peddling currently. When the book on insider trading was about to come out, I had a part-time colleague at George Washington Law Center, where I was teaching then, was Manny Cohen, who was then a high staff member at the SEC, but during that period became chairman of the SEC. I asked him if he would review the book. Although Manny Cohen had agreed to review the book for the George Washington Law Review, when the book came out and they found out that it was critical of the SEC, they called a high-level committee meeting at the SEC. I got friends there who told me everything that happened. They had a meeting to decide how to deal officially with this book. And they hit on a scheme that was unhappy for me, but I think was a good solution for them. They agreed that no one at the SEC could mention the book. They couldn't review it. They wouldn't talk about it. They would act like it didn't exist. So this started the SEC's focus of attention on me. Now, whether it was at that same meeting or another one, something happened that has been reported to me at least 10 times by people who knew. They had a rule that no staff member at the Securities and Exchange Commission in any of their work could cite anything written by Henry Manny.
Not just the insider trading book, but anything at all.
Anything. And it may have recognized that what I was doing really was had implications that went far beyond the little narrow subject of insider trading. It went to the very heart of the philosophy that agency right. was based on. And of course, that's what I chose to address in Wall Street in Transition. I wanted to call attention, and basically that's what it is, it's an elaborated article, calling attention to the number of ways that various parts of securities regulation were really just payoffs to special groups or protective of existing cartels, the worst kind of thing that people were beginning to notice about agencies, but no one had ever thought was true of the SEC. They thought it was the one agency that was really above reproach. Well, it wasn't, and today it's pretty well known. Today we regularly see out in the open in the press stories of whether the SEC will adopt a certain rule that will benefit or not benefit a particular group at the New York Stock Exchange. That used to be all well hidden until I wrote that little book that disclosed it was going on, that disclosed that the specialists on the floor of the exchange were getting very special kinds of benefits as a result of securities regulation that was supposed to be benefiting the public, but of course wasn't benefiting the public at all. At that point, I was writing regularly for Barron's magazine, and I had a couple of pieces in the New York Times in which I commented on how little influence modern economics had on what was one of the most important economic regulatory agencies we had. That they didn't even have, at that point, they didn't have an economist on the staff of the agency. They had accountants, but they didn't have economists. There was no, it was a lawyer's agency, pure and simple. And there was no one there who even recognized that economics had anything to do with this.
Right.
The stock market was the province of lawyers to regulate what got disclosed. It didn't have anything to do with finance economists. Well, I think they took note of that because somewhere around probably 1970, they formed an Office of Economic Policy in the SEC, and they staffed it with some very good economists and had zero influence on anyone there. That is still a staff-driven agency.
Yes.
They still have had some quite good economists who have written some work quite critical of the SEC. They have had no influence whatever on anything that I know of that that agency does. They're disregarded, but they have to be there because otherwise Henry Manning will tell everybody they don't have economists. But I always considered a great badge of honor that I had this regulatory bill of attainder almost at the SEC against me by name. It disappeared some years ago. As law and economics got to be very respectable, and as finance economics grew as a really important field with developments we've talked about, my work that had been really very, very, very specialized and known to only a few people, by the late 70s, it became extraordinarily important work. Everybody started an article by saying the seminal work is one of two or three things by me. And that got through to the SEC, too. And today, I even get a very respectful kind of response from the SEC, although sometimes I don't return it.
Your lecture in the Wall Street in Transition book, could you explain a little bit how that came about and what you were trying to accomplish in that piece?
In 1967, under the aegis of the American Enterprise Institute, I directed a conference that was absolutely the first comprehensive economic investigation of securities regulation. The economists were surprised even to find that there were so many nice subjects for them to treat. And that's still a commonly referred to volume that looks at a lot of different aspects of the economics of securities regulation. But as I became more anathema to the SEC, they also became more interesting to me. In the meanwhile, I had been heavily influenced by public choice theory, by the idea of takeover of agencies. A lot of the property rights economics got into this. And so when I had this opportunity to do a kind of comprehensive treatment of my views of the economics of what was important in securities regulation, that was what resulted in that little book. It still, I think, is the most comprehensive survey of possible economic approaches to securities regulation that we have. And, of course, it spawned a lot of additional work in the field. But it sort of was my tribute to the SEC, if you will.
Tell me which of all the things you've done you regard as the most important.
Oh, I guess I don't think there's any question that the little piece on the market for corporate control was critical. That was a profound restatement of our understanding of the large corporation. It has had, I think, enormous influence. It was really what I had aimed at for a long time, because from back in law school, everyone knew, at least in my circle, there was something wrong with the Burley and Means thesis about large corporations. We just didn't know what. And this was the breakthrough that let us explain why that great institution that makes us all so much better off continues to thrive and works very well in spite of some spotty faults here and there.
A paradigm shift?
Oh, I think it was. In the real sense of that term, it changed every scholar's attitude towards what they would write about corporations. Took the lawyers a little longer than the economists to catch on. The economists immediately recognized that this had opened something huge for them to deal with. Things moved rapidly. Starting 1968, I moved out of law teaching, largely because of frustration. The law professors, with a kind of know-nothing ignorance about this whole thing, decided that it was all ideological, that it wasn't good scholarship, it wasn't intellectual, it wasn't honest, it wasn't even in good faith. And there was no chance of my getting an appointment in those days at a major law school, because my name was just mud because of the emotional response to this work that I had been publishing. In a few years, that almost disappeared. There was a period there when there was just tremendous, wonderful excitement in this area. I think it probably, you could say, it started with Ronald Coase's famous article that was noted for his Nobel Prize, The Problem of Social Cost, that really was the primeval piece of law and economics scholarship. No one in the law teaching world thought you could have an intellectual movement in the field of corporations. It was not considered a major topic in law schools even. If you didn't teach torts or contracts, it really wasn't very important. And that's why I think my work really came into the mainstream of law and economics 10 or 15 years after it was written, not when it was written. I can remember overhearing a conversation at a meeting of the Association of American Law Schools, two people talking about me. I don't think they knew me. I didn't know them. One of them said, my name was mentioned, and someone said something about a conservative kook. And the other one said, no, he's not a conservative kook. He writes like Milton Friedman.
You mentioned Ronald Coase and the problem of social cost. Coase, of course, is famous also for his much earlier piece on the nature of the firm.
Right.
All the way back in 1937.
I always claimed a little credit for resurrecting. That piece had totally disappeared from any recognition in the literature. And when I found it, I realized that it was part of the picture that I was trying to draw. But the whole subject came alive. Alchin and Demsetz wrote their famous article on team production as part of the theory of corporations.
Right, in 1972.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were beginning to look at it then as a serious part of legal scholarship. It was almost palpable to me how attitudes towards me personally were beginning to change. I was beginning to get invitations. I got a call inviting me for a visiting professorship at the Yale Law School. That couldn't have happened 5 years earlier. So and there was an enormous change very rapidly.
What was it like to leave a law school, and you'd only been a law teacher, to go to a political science department in a university that didn't even have a law school?
What I found at Rochester was a first-rate intellectual climate. It was wonderful. The business school had really glummed on to what I had been writing in corporations. There were several people there, and out of that grew one of the most famous pieces of all in modern corporate literature, and that's the Jensen and Meckling piece on agency costs. Well, that's almost a direct outgrowth, as they acknowledge, of what I had done. But it's a great piece, and here were the people working on what I was interested in, the next building over from me. It's George Benston, who was one of the early people to recognize that there was something all wrong with the SEC's belief in the power of accounting to convey information. He was one of the few accounting economists in the country. Now, that was a combination that didn't create the furor that law and economics did, but there still weren't many people who could do that kind of work. And yet it was central, for instance, to that the piece you mentioned on Wall Street and transition. A large part of that was a critique of the SEC's reliance on a kind of bookkeeping accounting that really didn't make sense for regulatory purposes. So there were many people on the faculty at Rochester then that for the first time gave me a real intellectual milieu that I could feel comfortable with.
This distinction between accounting information and other kinds of information that investors value really harks back to your point about efficient capital markets in the market for corporate control.
That was, I had to invent that notion even before it was named by others and really invented by Fama and Jensen and others, because I needed something like that theory to understand the theory of insider trading and indeed the market for corporate control. I had to posit in the development of those arguments that the stock market pricing was correct. I had started a program in the summers to teach economics to law professors. It started off with a bang. The turnout was enormous, and the response to this course was fantastic enthusiasm. That program continued for 25 years. Over 650 law professors eventually went through it, and I think as much as anything that ever happened, it paved the way for the introduction of law and economics scholarship, which is certainly the strongest branch of scholarship in law schools today.
If you want anything done right, you do it yourself. You're going to teach these guys the economics.
Exactly. Well, and I used to joke, it wasn't totally a joke, many a truth is said in jest, that the reason I wanted to educate these law professors about economics was so they could understand what I had written 10 years earlier. At that point, I didn't have any doubts at all that law and economics was an extraordinarily important, new, and innovative field of scholarship. And I knew it was going to grow. I also recognized that it did have normative implications, that the economics we were talking about was the economics of free markets. The property rights we were talking about was property ownership, of a notion of economic freedom. Freedom of contract was a critical part of this whole thing. And so that when you looked at the whole package, you realized that you were dealing with the whole topic of liberty. And so I propose that we offer another parallel summer program teaching basic legal jurisprudence and fundamentals of law to economists. Then I proposed that there was a serious problem that had to be addressed of how we would produce new scholars in this field. And what I proposed that we should develop a specialized program, probably in a law school, to take either economics PhDs or people who are all but dissertation, ABDs, and design a specially tailored law school curriculum for them so that we would turn out really sophisticated scholars, in young scholars, in the field of law and economics. Then I propose that another thing we should do is try and bring together the economists who might be interested in various law and economics topics with the lawyers who are interested in a series of conferences. That prospectus was the format for what ultimately became the Law and Economics Center.
So you put the lawyers in the economics classes, you put the economists in the law classes. Not only do they each then know the other discipline, but they're able to talk to one another.
Yes. Law and economics really was truly a successful interdisciplinary activity. Law was almost desperate for some intellectual content, for some rigorous analytical tools. Economics was always starving for good topics. And so it was a natural fit, and it worked very well. I thought Miami would be a good place for two reasons. I could have more freedom from interference by the faculty. The dean seemed to be very friendly to the idea. And frankly, I wanted a place where I could hold all these conferences and things that I planned without having to travel. I had two young children then, and Miami was really one of the few spots that offered that kind of opportunity. So location had a great deal to do with my and subsequently your careers.
Yes.
The two really critical things, to my mind, were that fellowship program, because I thought that was the future of law and economics, to produce scholars who would go out into the law teaching world and many into economics, business schools, who would have this law and economics training. Well, enters into this one of the key people in the development of law and economics. His name was Frank O'Connell. He's quite elderly, but still alive. He was the director of the John M. Olin Foundation. He had been a labor lawyer in New York and was a very close advisor of Mr. Olin. He visited me for a full day in Rochester, as he said, to get educated about what this law and economics stuff was about. Well, I must have done a pretty good job, because at the end of the day, he left totally convinced that this was where the future really lay. I proposed the Olin, what became the very famous Olin Fellowship Program, to the John M. Olin Foundation, and they bought it. Through the Law and Economics Center, in your years, at least four or five people who later were given Nobel Prizes. Milton Friedman played an active role in one of the programs. George Stigler was there for a period. Jim Buchanan came for at least a semester, maybe longer. Ronald Coase was in a number of the programs there. So it was a heady atmosphere, and it was intellectual fun, certainly. But the fellowship program, as important as it was, as I said, there was another part of my prospectus that I give equal importance to for the development, really, of modern law and economics as a field, academic field. That was these conferences that I proposed doing. Well, in that, I had the same kind of good luck that I have with Frank O'Connell at the Olin Foundation. There was a man named Neil McLeod, who was then the president of the Liberty Fund of Indianapolis. As luck would have it, this was about the time that the Liberty Fund was beginning to think about what kind of programs it would operate. Mr. Goodrich had unfortunately died at that point, with whom I had long had a very nice personal relationship. But Neil McLeod, like Frank O'Connell, understood what I was saying and understood that the values they were into, the normative values they were interested in, were involved, but that it was first-rate scholarship, that it was something that would give you panache throughout the academic world. At any rate, before it was all over, I had directed, I think, 34 Liberty Fund colloquiums. There were all these topics in law that no economist had ever looked at. Do the economics of punitive damages, or the economics of liability for government officials, or the economics of bankruptcy? Nobody had ever done anything like that. There was no literature. These were totally new fields every time we did a Liberty Fund seminar on one of these topics. And of those 34 programs, I think 31 or 32 of them ended up as books or symposium issues of law journals, and was a tremendous jump start to the whole field of law and economics. One day, I don't know how, I began thinking, wouldn't it be nice if judges understood some economics? Not that they would write opinions as an economic article, but just to understand what was underlying the law they were dealing with and the facts they were dealing with. And that idea grew in my head. I still, even all these years later, I still think it was the nerviest thing imaginable. No one had ever conceived of the idea of a private program to educate federal judges. That's about as sensitive an idea as you can get. But the idea grew with me. I proceeded very, very carefully. I got the approval of the Chief Justice of the United States, the most powerful judicially political judge in the country, Judge Kaufman on the Second Circuit, and I got a ruling from the Federal Judicial Conference that we could do this. And in 1976, we held in November the first program in economics for federal judges. It had the most distinguished economics faculty ever assembled. The two most famous Nobel Prize winners, Milton Friedman and Paul Samuelson, both were in it. Paul McAvoy, Martin Feldstein, Armin Alchin, Harold Demsetz. And I gave a lecture on corporations. We barely scraped together 20, 21 judges. Well, that was November of 76, and we got our 21. I think we were after 25. February of 77, we announced the second program. A third of all the federal judges in the United States applied to come. We knew we had a success on our hands.
The word was out. Henry, back to the Law and Economics Center at the University of Miami. Having all of these programs, all this recognition, conferences and what have you, must have seemed a real boon to the law school itself.
Well, you would think it would have been seen that way, but it wasn't. I think many members of the faculty were very uneasy with having what they saw as an ideological conservative think tank as part of the law school or part of the university alongside the law school. At any rate, the timing was good. A good friend of mine, whom we had tried to get on the faculty Miami had took the deanship at Emory.
This is Tom Morgan.
Tom had spent some time at the center, was a University of Chicago graduate, had been through our economics program for law professors, had really made some reputation in his own field as a law and economics scholar. And he interested the president of Emory in this. It was a very valuable asset to give to another university. Well, eventually, Emory agreed to put up considerable money, and we moved the center with, I would say, over half of the staff to Atlanta. And so as a result, there were programs started at Yale, at Harvard, at Columbia, at Penn, at Duke, at Berkeley, all with Olin money. In time, that had tremendous influence on the direction that law and economics scholarship took. But there were other things starting to happen. Fundraising was not as easy in, 1981, 82, as it had been in 1974. For one thing, a lot of new programs had come online. Outfits like the Heritage Foundation and Cato in Washington began going to some of the same sources for funding. So we began cutting back on some of the programs. So I began looking for other opportunities. And one day, out of the blue, I got a call from my good friend Gordon Tullock, who at that point had gone to George Mason University. And he and Jim Buchanan had moved the Center for Public Choice from VPI to George Mason. George Mason was a brand new state university that was getting a lot of state money for buildings, and the president was pretty much a non-ideological guy. He would hire almost anyone of prominence that could come on the market, which was a good way to begin a university. And so I went up and had this meeting with George Johnson and explained to him what I thought were the shortcomings of legal education generally, and how a specialized focus in an intellectual field like law and economics could really cure a lot of the problems that existed in legal education and give them a jump start in prominence. And he began to sing a different tune that made a lot of sense to me. First of all, they had come into some money that he would provide a new dean for underwriting new programs, and most important, and the thing that really made me perk up, to buy out professors that they had there who had tenure that the university had given them when they'd acquired this old private law school. At any rate, I looked at the thing long and hard and decided there was enough money there that I maybe could do it. And certainly, it gave me a place to move the Law and Economics Center. So I accepted the deanship, and I told the faculty, and I told the Board of Trustees of the university, and I told the administration exactly what I planned to do. The only thing I didn't specifically say was that my first move when I be here is to announce to all the non-tenured professors that their contracts won't be renewed. I didn't say that, and I didn't say that I planned to buy out all the tenured professors that I could. And one of those, again, lucky little events that happens that can change your life. I was talking to George Johnson one day. I said, they're really the most disorganized faculty I ever saw. And he sat up in his chair and he said, if that's the case, any move you want to make, do it now.
Henry, when you talk about all the personnel changes during your first year as dean at George Mason, it risks to sound somewhat cold-hearted, but I happen to know that you helped many people get new and better jobs, and that you helped faculty members that you retained to advance their intellectual careers by subsidizing further education for them.
Not only that, but the overall quality of the law school, the public perception of the law school really soared.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. It went from this nondescript institution that you inherited to a real up-and-coming first-class group.
Yeah, it is today. I think, really is one of the three or four really interesting law schools in the country. You know, the idea of having specialized law schools, which had been anathema in legal education, is increasingly popular today. And I think we're going to see a lot of it in the next few years as the group of students going to law school is going to get smaller as a demographic matter. I think we're going to see other law schools turning in this direction, that either they'll be intellectually specialized or they'll be professionally subject area specialized.
And I have the sense that there's a little bit less emphasis on programs for lawyers and for economists than there was before.
Yes. One of the interesting things about this academic development of law and economics is that it turned out to be, as its origins would suggest, much more important to lawyers and law professors than to economists. On the other hand, law and economics in Europe has taken a very different turn. It became enormously popular. There were centers for a while, I don't know if they still continue it, at Oxford, at Hamburg, at Heidelberg, at Turin, at Milan. France almost got into this, not at all. There were almost no law and economics people in France. I don't know why. It has something to do with the whole nature of their university system, I suppose. But law and economics is very big in Europe, and it's gotten very big in Japan. All in Europe and in Japan, there are non-English language journals in law and economics. But in Europe, you can get a PhD in economics with a specialty in law and economics.
Well, as you look back on your experience at all these different institutions where you've been, and as someone who has also written about the way the modern university governs itself and what have you, I mean, you mentioned, for example, the growing lack of civility and the fact that the growing lack of tolerance, if you will, lack of respect for one another's opinions and what have you. Is that the sort of thing you were writing about when you wrote about universities?
Well, yeah. Actually, my interest in corporations always made me think about the university, which is a totally different kind of institution. It was large, there were a lot of physical assets. You would think that it would have a lot of similarity to a manufacturing company. Instead of manufacturing goods, it was manufacturing a service product of education and turning out students who were different, you hope, than when they arrived. But it was hard to figure out exactly what these differences were. Two of my great heroes, Armin Alchin and Jim Buchanan, had each written pieces about this, but neither from a kind of legal perspective. Well, one happenstance, one happy occasion, I was invited to a Liberty Fund program on higher education. Pierre Goodrich was still alive then. It was not too long before he died, I think, here in Indianapolis. And I did a paper for that, which really let me, writing a paper, as you know, is a way of manufacturing new ideas that somehow you don't get until you either teach it in a class or write it in an article. And I began to understand that historically, the property rights structure of nonprofit organizations, going all the way back to Henry VIII and his fight with the Catholic Church, but his adoption of his acceptance of the statute of charitable uses, which allowed charitable organizations to exist in perpetuity. See, prior to that statute, only the church, well, some minor exceptions, had that benefit, and he'd broken with the church. And so now the state owned these universities and monasteries and what have you. So he allowed them to exist in perpetuity. What that meant was that if you take property in perpetuity, and leave it in one place, you insulate it from market forces. It means that property over decades and centuries even never gets subjected to the really acid test of market survival. And this in turn allows totally different kind of behavior. Well, that was the thrust of this article, and I used that understanding to describe a lot of the peculiarities we find in universities, the behavior of professors, the relationship of professors to students, the administration's role, why the faculty over a period of time displaced the trustees or churches as having any significant role in giving guidance to the university. My own life and my own career, I think, has given me a lot of footnotes that I could add to a revision of that article. So many of the things that I experienced, fights in some cases with a dean of a law school, occasionally with the president of a university, these are things that I can recognize would never come about in that way in a corporation where someone owned the assets and where there was a built-in pressure to manage those assets in an efficient way with a goal that everyone understood.
And incentives properly aligned.
That's right.
Among faculty and among administrators so that those who further the common
exactly.
goal are rewarded and those who don't are punished.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing an almost grotesque development along those lines in universities today. I find them, in many, many examples, not very happy places to be. They don't have the sense of respect for freedom that the best of them used to have, intellectual freedom as well as personal freedom. That's a great loss. On the other hand, there are new developments the market's providing in the educational world that may eventually displace universities. I don't know.
Right. It's already happening.
It's beginning to happen, yeah.
What do you think's going to happen in the future?
It's very hard to predict in dealing with developments in universities because so much of what happens in universities is arbitrary. It's not really guided by any sensible goal. So it's very hard to say. One of the things I do know, however, about the university world, and I think it's even more true than in the corporate field, is that if you find the occasional entrepreneur, and believe me, there are far fewer in the university world than there are in the corporate business community, an entrepreneur can really make a difference. An individual can make an enormous difference. I think George Johnson was an entrepreneur. He made a difference. George Mason is today a very important university. A lot of the free market, classical liberal thinking of the United States is centered at George Mason because this guy wanted something good. In Austrian economic terms, the very definition of an entrepreneur is someone who comes up with an idea that no one ever thought of before.
Well, and the very chain of events that you described that resulted in your being a George Mason is proof of what you're
yeah.
talking about.
Yeah.
It just so happens that Gordon Tullock was there. He knew that you had a vision, and Gordon puts the two of you together, and the rest is
yeah,
history.
That's right. Many universities have episodes of this. The University of Chicago had two. The first famous president, William Rainey Harper, there was a great entrepreneur. And then Robert Maynard Hutchins
yeah.
Gave a character to that university that has lasted almost thoroughly until today. And I think there are other universities. So maybe good things will still happen. It's hard to say.
One of the programs that we haven't talked about is the Supreme Court Economic Review.
Yes.
Was that started in Miami?
Yes. Yes, it was. And again, with tremendous piece of good luck. I had, when I was a professor, a chair professor in the political science department at the University of Rochester, there was a graduate student who had a master's degree in economics. His name was Peter Aronson. and I thought he was one of the smartest guys I ever met. At that point, he was teaching either at University of Minnesota or Georgia Tech, I can't remember which, but I induced him to come join the Law and Economics Center. And he
took, Miami.
In Miami. But it was the first year, and then the next year we went to Atlanta. He went along, and he agreed to edit this journal that would bring an economic focus on the work of the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, from the beginning, it was very well done, very scholarly journal, peer-reviewed, of course, and has been one of the major law and economics journals.
Not to close on a down note. Any disappointments?
Disappointments?
Anything you'd do differently?
Well, I've enjoyed my life because there's been a lot of excitement in it. In the early years, it was pure intellectual excitement. But, you know, as I moved from intellectual thrills to entrepreneurial thrills and really built something, it's hard to think about the distressing points.
Henry, it's been a great pleasure. I want to thank you for taking the time, and I want to thank Liberty Fund for making it possible.
And thank you.
Henry Manny, visionary, scholar, innovator, leader. His insight and views have changed institutions, changed the way law and economics is taught, and changed the theory of the corporate firm. His contributions to the understanding of market forces and the true effects of market regulation have been immeasurable. This has been A Conversation with Henry Manny. A production of The Liberty Fund. For further information on related series programs or subjects, visit libertyfund.org.